Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
Well, thank you very much, all four of you, both for content and for making my life so easy as chair by sticking to time. Just a couple of thoughts whilst people are thinking about their questions. Graham, you were talking about the sort of activity on the boundaries. Level four and level three at the same time. There was an article, you said there was an article in the Times Higher that made you cross. There was one that I thought was marvellous about a year or two ago, where a London university was teaching a university law course in a sixth form college. And young people who knew perfectly well university wasn't for them were just blown away by the fact that they could do this course, and it completely transformed their expectations. So I agree that, and sort of, Lynn, you were talking about sort of new audiences we hadn't thought of but should be scanning for. I mean, this is one way of scanning. But my reaction when I thought about it was that when mobile phones were first introduced, a very minor application so far as the mobile phone carriers was concerned was something called text messages, which wouldn't transfer across networks and was clearly very unimportant. What made it important was users. Nothing to do with the supply side, it was the demand side. So as well as scanning, as a sector, FE and AT, we need to be responsive. And if people out there respond in a certain way, we need to recognise it and do something about it. Well, we've got a splendid amount of time for questions and comments. So, questions, comments. There's one at the back.
Hello there. David Walker, Director of a Programme at Career Academies UK, education charity, works to raise aspirations and improve employability of 16 and 19-year-olds, mainly middle-achieving at level 3 students, a mix of BTEC and A-level and so forth. I was really interested particularly in what Lynn said about the range of routes that are now opening to young people, you know, all around level four, higher apprenticeship, school leaver programs, approaches like that. Interestingly, ourselves and the Financial Skills Partnership have done some research, which won't be out for another week or so. But what we really got, we surveyed many hundreds of young people across the country earlier this year that have on the Career Academy program, and what we got was they really value the university experience. They really value it for the sense of the student experience and that sense of it broadening their lives, even though the vast majority of the students we work with are studying things like business. They recognise that. But their big thing for other routes, whether that was school leaver programmes or apprenticeships, some were what you would expect, the obvious prejudices that come through about dirty rags and the like. But actually it was, what's the progression? I can see that university keeps my options open, and then where do I go? Whereas if I commit to a high-level apprenticeship or a school leaver programme, am I tying myself down to that one organisation? And I think the big thing that came out of that is, if you've got a wider mixed market, you know, how and what the university is going to do and the higher education system generally to respond to those sort of concerns and ensure that, you know, as it maybe was before we had a entry system, the people who were starting off in technical jobs would then look to do a HND at a university and perhaps consider taking it from there. You know, how is that provision provided and how is it signposted? Because what we got very loud and clear is that young people just aren't getting those messages.
I think that's a really valid point, because I think what you've got, and all the work that Simon Hughes did around sort of finding out what people know and people don't know and how can you shift the information base. It's people having understandings of what the possibilities are. I mean, I was VP for HE in a mixed economy college in the 80s, and we had more hassle getting our tutors to accept our vocational students in the universities. Probably shouldn't say that, but it was true. So there's also a huge thing about that way in which those progressions, those ladders, those understandings of different kinds of learners and aspirations can actually lead in different ways. I'm a baby boomer. I'm a grammar school, working class grammar school kid who went to university. I think the experience of university is something that everybody should have, actually, personally, that whole campus experience. So I think your research will add to the mix in terms of understanding that. It's how universities enable that broader mix, that different kind of learner, not just in terms of vocational or academic aspirations, but learning styles, ways of learning, how you succeed, how you stay motivated. That's what I was talking about in that pedagogies and ways of learning angle. It's having that diversity that encompasses at that broader spectrum and allows that progression. But until that shifts, it was what I didn't talk about. Also, it's the corporate in-houses, the KPMGs, the PwCs. It was on my list. But, all, you know, they are now offering, because I think there is a mindset, I'll be interested in what Graeme says, for there has been, people wanting jobs. That level of graduate unemployment, the fear that you're going to end up in a call centre, nothing against call centres, but that's not what your aspiration was, is, I think, leading the next group that are coming through to say, well, how do I guarantee a job? That seems to be paramount for those who will need to earn. Mm. Yeah,
but employability and work experience, not just for getting a job, but for going to university and that being recognised. Yeah, was something that was really high on the agenda. That's something we promote anyway, but we were really struck at how much young people really understand that. You know, and we're looking and saying, well, you know, what are my roots going to do to make me employable in future? That was their number one concern.
Can I just think about, I think that one of the problems that we have is that we kind of come to this issue when kids are post-16, and it's kind of sort of just, they're dropped in it there and then. My concern, even though policy exchange have backed Michael Gove and many things, my concern at the minute with the EBAC and with what the government are doing on academic education in schools is that they're not giving enough voice and attention to the vocational and to those routes from an earlier age. I think that it's a bit unfair to just assume that you kind of take kids to the age of 16, they all do the same thing, and then you suddenly expect them to be able to sort of, well, you go. It's very clear if you're thinking of university, it's very clear at the minute what you have to do. But if you hit 16 and you've been doing the same route as everybody else, and then you think, well, actually, that's not the route I want to go, I want to do something different, you're quite right, it's not very clear to you. If this government or any future government could try and give more emphasis to the vocational from an earlier age and in a very structured way, from the age of 14, for example, I think that would be a positive thing. And we see that with UTCs, and I know that UTCs have been maybe talked about and bandied about. It's a bit of a hackneyed phrase, but the experience that I've seen of the only one or two that are up and running at the minute is that the kids are actually much more attuned to they're doing what they want to do from the age of 14. They're more attuned to the working environment and to employers. And that actually gives them the tools they need, the vocabulary they need, the confidence they need at the age of 18, 19 to go off and take those different routes. I think that's one that this government have got to try and find ways. Whether they can use FE colleges in doing it, I don't know. If there's some route to trying to get more kids from that age involved in vocational, but it's just a sense that I have at the moment, there's a bit of a disjoint happening.
And I've written down a box with four elements. You've got theoretical degrees and vocational degrees, and you've got FE and you've got HE, and traditionally they've been separate boxes. And what needs to happen is that they blend into each other like colours of the rainbow, so that you can go on to whatever qualification you want, and there is an onward route out of it. I mean, it seems to me batty to say that if you get a plumbing qualification, that counts as zero towards a degree. It should be something you can build on with business studies modules or other things to turn into a degree, and I think with apprenticeships as well. But it's something that thinking up to now has been very, very timid about. I actually think politicians have been afraid of offending universities. I would hope that universities would take a very robust, open-minded attitude towards things like that, if only from the narrow self-interest that if we want more students, getting some from FE would be a thoroughly good idea. But yeah. I think sort of colours of the rainbow rather than separate boxes hasn't happened, you're quite right, and it jolly well needs to happen.
I actually think that we should go much further and recognise that in any subject, and make the argument that in any subject domain, however academic, you can find the vocational. And in any subject domain, however vocational, you can find the academic. So if you're a plumber, if you're studying a plumbing course, then it actually isn't conceptually very far from the Archimedes screw, from the history of moving water around on a grand scale. And if you're studying classics, kind of the ultimate academic degree, you can't succeed in that course without studying rhetoric, the art of persuasion. You can't get more vocational than that in a 21st century democracy. So trying to find at all points the connections seems important.
And I've been around so long, it feels. I remember the accreditation of prior learning, accreditation of prior experiential learning, the whole modular time when we were trying to modularise everything. And that was all about exactly what you're saying. And I think perhaps we need to be more sophisticated, but I think it's time again to look at those approaches that pick and mix, that was behind my pick and mix point, that blend, that enable the best to come out of whatever and whoever is studying and experiencing, you know, those programmes.
But then overlaying that is the fact that some people learn best by doing the theory first and then the applications, and others learn best by getting their hands dirty and motivated and then understand why they're doing the theory. And a diverse system of tertiary education should allow people to choose the mode of learning that suits them best.
I think a lot of this depends on the relationships between FE colleges and universities, and I think the concern that I would have is that the policy is pushing those two apart to be seen in competition. You know, and Hertfordshire is like some universities kept a very strong consortium, and I think we feel the pressure is to kind of pull those apart, even when they're working quite effectively in terms of creating those kind of mixings and ladders of opportunity. Quite right that some FE colleges should be going alone and having their own numbers, but they shouldn't assume that model should always work for all local circumstances.
One of the things I was saying this morning is one of the crazinesses of the present system of finance is with a student numbers cap, HE and FE are competing for the same students, and that has to be wrong. Question? Comment? Plenty of time. Is somebody prepared to say something outrageous? Good.
Hello, I'm Angie Milan. I'm the marketing director of the College of Law. We're a new entrant. Nice to meet you all. I just want to make the point that I think it's inspired, the conversation that I'm hearing. It's very inspirational, but I do think we need the support and the backing of the employers. If we're going to mix it up, we need them to agree to it. We need them to support it. We need them also to participate in lobbying the government to say that these are the kind of people we want from the education sector. That's the only outrageous point I wanted to make. Thank you. Or I could also add the point that, of course, we survive in the market at the College of Law because we are so closely linked to the employers. You know, we are lobbying them, we participate with them, and, you know, and our standards are driven by them, basically. So it's an extremely close relationship. Thank you.
It's a difficult balance to get, I think. You're in a unique position, I would argue.
In a niche position.
You're in a very niche position, and you have a very specific offering which the law firms can more or less come to you and can work with you very clearly. And I think that there will be ways in which businesses can do that with universities, and I think KPMG have done that with Durham in developing an accountancy qualification. The same applies to earlier on in education as well, to the curriculum and to schools. I'm always a little bit wary when it comes to businesses and business involvement and education for the reason that I think I never seem to get the same consistent message from two different employers. Two different employers will want two different things. I think that work experience, and I think that trying to get as many young people who are doing sandwich degrees and all of those sorts of things clearly beneficial and to be encouraged, but I'm not sure I could apply the College of Law model to many other universities.
It doesn't have to be the same, does it?
No.
But I think it's important that there is an acknowledgement.
Sorry, could you just wait for the microphone?
Sorry.
television?
It doesn't have to be the same as, but I think there is something to be said from the employer's acknowledgement that they will take on people and won't be prejudiced against people, for instance, when they're employing their high-caliber management or even them or whoever, if they've mixed up their subjects in the way that you're proposing, because I think that's a, I think that is an in, that those are inspirational ideas to me.
Well, perhaps Graham, from you, I did think it was interesting to the notion that you could study a management NVQ and a history degree at the same time. I'm not sure. I mean, you could. I'm a bit of a my. You wouldn't think I work in a think tank, and so I should be completely blue sky. But I'm not actually. I think. Right, how does that work practically? If a university could come up with a way of doing that and working with an FE college or working with someone else to deliver those two side by side, that would be great. But you would have to change around timetables, you'd have to change around term times, you'd have to perhaps increase the length of time that you stayed at university. You could do it. There's no reason why, you know, we should have a system whereby you could go and do that during the summer. If you're studying a history degree in, at a university, why can't you use the 2-3 months in the summer to go and study an NVQ? Part of it 1 year, part of it the next year.
But when I was an undergraduate doing a liberal arts degree, the institution that I was studying in was located less than 10 minutes walk from the local further education college, which was offering NVQ management so often on so many different patterns that if I thought about it, I could have done it myself.
Yes.
Without requiring the institutions to collaborate at all.
Yes.
I could have just left a lecture, gone down the road, gone into the other classroom. But one
asked a question, therefore, as a student, what am I getting for my money if I have enough time in my hands to pay for... I'm paying for my degree, and I'm also paying for an NVQ, so what am I actually getting for my degree?
Sorry. The point I wanted to make, I'm Bob Hogg from Circle, the point I wanted to make was I did that as a student. 40-odd years ago, I trained as a teacher. And by training as a teacher, I studied a subject, and I also took a vocational qualification in how to teach. Now, it just happened that some of those were at different institutions, all as part of the University of London, but I had to move around to different places. So somebody somewhere had the wit to be able to put the vocational elements, how do you teach, with the subject elements about making sure you have the knowledge and understanding to be able to teach that subject. I would say somebody somewhere should be able to put together plumbing and management studies.
Yes.
But James is absolutely right. The regimens of the funding system tend against it. You can borrow the money from the government to pay the fees in higher education, but you would have to borrow from your bank or find them for your savings to simultaneously study in further education. But can we tailor a funding system and a structure that allows that to be mitigated or set aside and invite institutions to collaborate to make the structural side easier? Sorry, that's my question.
Give the student the money. Give the student the money.
Maybe.
I mean, I think, as I was saying this morning, it's batty that you don't have loans that cover the whole of tertiary education, including postgraduate. That needs to happen. Funding universities not per year or full-time equivalent, but in a much more modular way, making part-time options much more flexible so that a student can do a history degree part-time and a management NVQ part-time. It's not difficult to do in principle if the funding regime makes it possible. It's impossible if you've got a clunky, ill-designed regime of higher education finance, which is why I said this morning finance is deeply boring, but unless you get it right, it gets in the way of all the stuff that's important.
James Macmillan from Skanska again. Again, I'd like to reiterate how interesting the conversation has been this afternoon. I was just going to say the one elephant in the room, which as a business we're finding extremely difficult, of course, is the economic climate, which means, of course, our traditional ways of involving, as we've been speaking here with my colleague here, is that we are not taking on people. And you were saying about how every business is different, how you work with them. Well, yes, because we are trying everything to stay in business. So I would just say, yes, the higher education FE is a massive discussion, but it has to also be a fact of that outside of it is not very attractive as a working environment. And your help in trying to leverage that and make it more of an attractive environment by using your skills and brains to help get things going would be very welcome, and please, that's my point.
I think that's absolutely vital. And with the raising of the participation age, if it's not just to be sort of keeping youngsters in education to keep the unemployment figures down, if it's to be meaningful, then we need the system. I mean, FE colleges at their best can pride themselves on relation with employers, and we always get bashed for not being good enough in that. It depends where you sit in the spectrum. So I think that whole, and same with universities, I think there's excellent work as well as things that can be better. So I think that we do have an economic system that's struggling. So how are we different in working with employers? And I think that's why UK Skills is putting the employer projects out. So how will employers, if they're directly funded, differently work towards that development and training? And will that change the system? And what you think about that is something else. But it's another system intervention, isn't it, to experiment with how best do we relate to that? And again, I think that point about job creators, different sorts of skilled individuals, different sorts of mindsets, different sorts of interpersonal skills that actually can assist, you know, not just in creating vacancies, but generating different ways of the economy boosting itself and generating productivity.
Yeah. I think that comes back to, I suppose, the first of my challenges, really, is how you make local economic development actually work. And I think one of the roles we need the LEPs to do is to act as a conduit to express, so we have many-to-many conversations between SMEs particularly and with many universities to try and sort of broker that conversation and make it work. And I heard yesterday that if you subsidise an intervention with SME, 70% of those will end up putting in back in more than that, because once they recognise the value of a particular kind of higher education intervention, they will then go on to do bigger things. So you might start with, you know, a very small piece of consultancy funded by an innovation voucher that may get turned into a mini KTP, a bigger KTP, an internship, a graduate placement. So I think we really need to look to the LEPs to try and at least kickstart some of those contacts between universities and business.
Two quick things. I think that right now, at the level 3 and level 5 levels, either side of level 4 undergraduate, we could right now have a funding system in which businesses don't pay the fees, they pay the risk of the default on the loan that the student takes to pay the fee, and that would both save businesses money and incentivise them to put more of their workforce into advanced training, and then incentivise those people to remain employed there and in general. The second thing is, I referred to a surfeit of people with doctoral qualifications emerging from universities and then struggling in the traditional academic labour market. What if they could be employed by universities and work as consultants to come in and work in the private sector or the voluntary sector? You wouldn't be taking on the risk of employing them, but they would be gainfully employed and
so
using their
qualifications. Employed by who?
The institutions.
But I think the difficulty is it comes back to the financing and the funding and the money. And you're quite right to point out in what you said, that it seems a shame that we have all these students who aren't taught and all these PhD students that are qualified to do so. But the bottom line is it's not as simple as that, because the students don't. It's not the case that the student can just go and say, right, here's my money, I want to be taught. The government has to get involved in some way. It has to be subsidised to some extent, and there's only so much money to go around.
But my understanding, Graeme was talking about what I was talking about, the entrepreneurial, is how do educational institutions start to become social enterprises? How do they serve their local communities, not just giving education, they're just their very structure.
Yeah.
So they're establishing innovation hubs with a pool of people that otherwise might not go anywhere else, but they could accumulate around the university. They're generating enterprises. They are setting up learning companies. They are developing students to be entrepreneurial, to be job creators alongside their studies as integral to that. It's just a completely different mindset of the nature of the...
But it is. But I think Graham's particular point was on... I'm thinking very specifically here of having all of these. I have all of these doctoral students or qualified people on one side, I have all of these students on another. And yes, in an ideal world, the two could come together and you could teach as many as you wanted to teach. But the bottom line is that the government has to subsidise the number of students in order to put them through. And as a country, we haven't made the decision to make that investment. So it's a fundamental investment on the part of Treasury.
Yes, but two things. That is exactly what I said when I was up there, but just now I was saying that if our colleague here can't take on the risk of taking on an employee with specialised expertise to that level, but you could expend some resources on buying in that support from someone who's employed by an institution who has those expertise, it's a model that could take us forward.
I think there are universities that are doing that. I mean, one way of subsidising that first contact is to use something like the Graduate Consulting Unit of Hertfordshire, and I'm sure there are many other examples out there, where you're giving a graduate the capacity to support an SME in a particular task. You know, that is clearly a subsidised, you know, if you paid a consultancy to do that, it would cost several times more. That's a way of subsidising that first contact and then building capacity. So I absolutely take your point about it being an entrepreneurial mindset that universities can take on.
Time for one last question.
Sorry, good afternoon. Ellen Ryan from the Institution of Civil Engineers. We were talking about what one of your comments up there was, how important sandwich degrees are in introducing graduates to the world of work, giving them skills. And sorry, the current economic climate in construction means that companies are not able to take on as many sandwich students as the universities have places for. So we're finding when we go and visit universities that they recruit lots of potential sandwich students, but there isn't the placement there for them. And secondly, we've been working with colleges, my colleague Andrew Stanley has, to develop an engineering apprenticeship in civil engineering, starting at the FE level, hopefully looking at working it up to advanced apprenticeships. And we are getting lots of employer support for that. So I think there are changes in the environment that are happening. But as you say, how do you capture the good practice and how do you disseminate it further?
Excellent. No, I mean, I think a couple of things. I think one is another way universities can be entrepreneurial is by employing their own students on sandwich placements. So, you know, Hertfordshire, for example, is going through a 10-year estates master plan, massive amounts of design and construction going to be going on. That, you know, why not be taking on student placements to be part of that? I've got a student placement in my team. It's always been fantastic. I think the other thing is to try and think about ways in which that sandwich placement can be split up, such that perhaps that's a succession of, say, three-month placements, so that the risk is lower for the individual employer. And maybe there's ways in which, again, the LEP can structure a consortia of employers so those placements can still happen. And the university then has responsibility for trying to integrate in that experience, making sure the portfolio is being put together, adequate academic supervision. So hopefully there can be some form of win-win for all the parties.
And my sense is Generation Y, Z, or whatever they're going to be, that will be natural to them. Those risks, not expecting a salaried career until you're 60, it just won't be in their mindset. So I think that the mix between us oldies thinking about it, who run the institutions, and the young people coming through with their expectations, I think there'll come a cusp point where it will shift and integrate and move, I think, more quickly. But I'm a pathological optimist.
Well, I'm very glad that, and again, thanks to all of you for keeping your interventions fairly short, because that did open up the space for what I thought was a terrific discussion. So thank you very much for your presentations and for your participation in the discussion.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.